Alistair Crowley was many things. A mountaineer, a poet, a magician, a philosopher. Even today, his writings on the occult are revered as classics. But Crowley remains a controversial figure. Surrounded by myths, lies and half-truths, the real Alistair Crowley is buried deep within the mystery that surrounds him. In this podcast, I'll be talking a little bit about how I came to write the play and the process I've gone through in trying to find the man behind the myth.
I first encountered Alistair Crowley when I moved to Inverness in the heart of the Highlands, really to pursue my passion, as it was then, for mountaineering. I walked into the meeting of the Inverness Mountaineering Club, and then they kept a logbook where people wrote about their feats in the Highlands. And when I opened the book, there, looking out at me with his characteristic stare, was Alistair Crowley. The club had sort of adopted him as a kind of mascot, I suppose. When I asked people who he was, I got a wide variety of answers. I got the usual myths about his madness, about his dabbling in the occult, and about him threatening people with revolvers on mountains. Some of which was partially true, most of which was basically fiction. And then I left it merely for many years. And as I became involved as a writer, I decided at one point that I would try and find out a little more about this enigmatic individual who had lived not far from where I reside in Inverness. And I began reading a variety of books and texts about him, really. And one of the things that fascinated me about Crowley was that here was a man absolutely full of contradictions. He was, on the one hand, supremely arrogant and almost totally self-centered. Yet at the same time, he could be compassionate. He was certainly very caring and concerned about the Sherpas that he was responsible for. He was also someone, I think, who actually was passionate in his search for truth, if you like, in his search for the truth that lies behind the magic that he performed. And yet, he was also someone who was not above lying about his abilities. He lied, for example, for a long time about his ability with languages. So around Crowley, and there exists a web of myth, I think. And certainly I found it in my researches with him. Extremely difficult to find who this man is. The journey into Crowley to write the play is I think closer to entering a maze than entering, if you like, a room with a man in it. For example, if you wrote I think a book about Scott or Houdini, for example, who's mentioned in the play, I think you would find a fair consensus about what the man was like. And yet with Crowley, when you delve into his personality, he seems to have hugely conflicting attitudes towards him. Some people clearly love and are obsessed by the man and perhaps have an unhealthy almost interest in him. Others are reviled by him. Come forth, O children under the stars, and take your fill of love. For I am above you and in you. My joy is in your joy. My ecstasy is yours. But know that to love me is better than all things. Come before me in a single robe, with a headdress of rich jewels. I yearn for you, I who am all pleasures. Pale, purple, veiled or voluptuous, I desire you.
on wings. Arouse the coiled splendor within you and release your innermost desire. Come unto me.
And there are so many bizarre myths. For example, when the play was premiered as part of a workshop performance up here, it was reported in the paper, the local paper, that Crowley had performed acts of ritual child murder and cannibalism at his house in Burleskin. Now, there's absolutely no evidence for any of that, and certainly there may be interpretations of the writings of the Book of Law, whoever one thinks actually wrote that, whether it was Crowley or whether he was writing it under the possession, if you like, of an emissary of Horus. But well, Crowley himself would have been revolted by that, and certainly never sacrificed anyone, to my knowledge. And if you look at other depictions of Crowley, I think they've been fairly shallow, really. Simon Callow, a fine actor in Chemical Wedding. But the portrayal of Crowley within that was one-sided. It was of a hedonist, a brutal individual who thought nothing of murdering people around him. And yet, there is so much more to Crowley like that. I hear him dismissed as a charlatan. My view, certainly, of Crowley was that he was certainly not a charlatan. Yes, at times I think he exaggerated what he did, and I think if you read some of his magical writings, I think they are deliberately obscure. However, there is a sincerity within what he does. Crowley also seemed to me, perhaps in some ways, to be the first of a modern man. And I mean by that that he lost his religion. Another contradiction of Crowley is that he was born into a Plymouth Brethren family, a devoutly religious, devoutly Christian, and found himself at the end of his life having, if you like, hurled all that away and become, I suppose you would call him, a devotee of the occult, perhaps the leading devotee of the occult there has ever been, really. I think it's important to realise that these, in the modern era, we regard magic, if you like, I think totally differently from the way that Crowley related to it. Crowley's magic wasn't Satanism. He certainly didn't worship Satan, as some people have said that he does. Satanism is I think, I suppose, the mirror image of Christianity. If you're going to have Christ and Christianity, then if you're going to be a Satanist, then actually you're in a way upholding the Christian ethic, because you're saying that there is a Satan, I will go, if you like, to the other side. So his magic was really, his magic came from the magic of the ancient pharaohs, really, originated there, I think. Although I'm no great scholar of his magic, I have to say. But it also, and I think in the play, Crowley says at one point, imagine if within us all there is a door to another universe, and all we have to do is find the key. Now, I think that actually is the fundamental, that is at the centre, I think, of Crowley's magic. What he was seeking for, a meaning for life that didn't have a Christian God within it. He sought, although he denied Christianity, if you like, and turned away from it, I think the rest of his life was spent really trying to find something that would substitute for it. Whether that was drugs, sexuality, hedonism, all the kind of things that he did. And another issue I think that came out from my research was that here was a man, actually, who of some note. I think of an important figure, I mean, I think that they say that the line between genius and madness is very fine. And I think Crowley almost walked that line. Though there might have been a fine poet there. There might have been a philosopher. He was almost many things. I suppose, at the end, I think that his arrogance and his reluctance to take on board the views of other people probably destroyed him. Had he listened to criticism of his poetry, he might have refined it, but being Aleister Crowley, he listened to no one. Certainly one thing Crowley sought all his life, I think, was some kind of, I suppose, fame, recognition. He, of course, found infamy. And I think, again, he revelled in that to an extent, although in many ways it brought about his demise. His courage, I think, was enormous. And I think his courage is shown in his mountaineering exploits, and also, I think, in his refusal to compromise in terms of his own ideas and his own concepts. I share things in common with Crowley, I guess. You don't write or you don't perform as a man unless you can at least find some connection. And certainly, you know, you can see in his mountaineering, I think you can at least get some measure of what this man was like. Crowley came to the outdoors, as many do, I think, to perhaps find an escape from the life that he found himself in. When his father died, he was shunted from one public school in southern England to another. And public schools in Victorian England must have been pretty dark and brutal establishments. There can be no doubt about that. And Crowley didn't fit in many ways. His interests and his passions were those which the thugs and the bullies within the schools found difficult to accept. And it was in mountaineering and in climbing that he found a freedom and an ability to express himself physically and to face challenges and to experience the beauty of the world around him, really. And that's a very common thing for mountaineers to have experienced. Now, the mountain, and I think what interests me about his mountaineering feats, the mountains are no respecters of character. They are, I think, one of the interesting things about Crowley and his mountaineering career is that the mountains form, I suppose, a very savage arena. They are not places that the normal boundaries, if you like, of behaviour can, they're not places where the normal boundaries of behaviour exist. You can boast to everyone about what a great climber you are and about what a fine mountaineer you have become, but as soon as you set foot on the mountains, you're in an environment that will be extremely unforgiving if you have exaggerated those claims. Pasha came down to us, his great shoulders flagging. I could see his courage was failing him. They all wanted to go down. I told them it was madness, for slope had changed to snow, unstable now, would avalanche. Pasha, if you go down now, you'll be dead in 10 minutes. Stay here. Don't go. But I could not persuade him to stay. They went. I climbed into my tent and waited. I was wrong. 10 minutes later, they were still alive. It took 15 for the avalanche to take them. The snow carried Pasha and 5 others to their deaths. I heard the survivors calling. Their cries carried to me in the wind. I remained in my tent. It's important to realise that Crowley, in his attempts to climb Kanchenjunga and K2, was climbing right at the forefront, right at the foremost edge of mountaineering in those days. No one had so far conquered any of these huge Himalayan peaks, and they remain an enormous feat today, and many people fail, even today, even with modern equipment, and with the kind of safety nets of modern civilization around us. But when Crowley was leading the expedition on Kanchenjunga, for example, he was right at the edge of the known universe, in a way. No one had climbed that high before, or very, very few had been higher. Conway's expedition had been a little bit higher than Crowley actually achieved, but on a much easier mountain. And he was climbing in a place really where to slip and to break one's ankle would be fatal. There was no rescue, there was no backup, and no one knew what lay around the next corner. And if you read his writings, he was clearly a man who knew about mountaineering, who had made a study of it, and was extremely proficient. So I think that testifies to his courage, to his abilities. As a mountaineer alone, he achieved a great deal. But there are also, I think, some sad things about in what Crowley actually failed to achieve, because his writing and his poetry. His poetry in particular. I think if Crowley could have been anything, if he had, if you like, one fairy to grant a wish, I think Crowley would have been a poet alongside Keats and Shelley and people like that, who are, I suppose, the giant figures of English literature. And yet, unfortunately, his writing was nowhere near that standard. Perhaps, I think, in part because he didn't listen to criticism. Perhaps, but there was a talent there. There was an ability. So I'll be performing my play about Aleister Crowley in the Edinburgh Fringe this year. It's not a defence of Crowley. I've tried to explore him fairly, to look at the dark sides of his character, and also to look at what some of the lighter sides of his character, and some of the admirable characteristics, and some of the great things that he did. But just to tell you a little bit about the play, it's set essentially in the dressing room of a small provincial theatre, and Crowley, down on his luck, is performing. I suppose you'd have to describe it as a magic act to earn a living. And he goes back really through the significant events in his life: his mountaineering, the writing of the Book of Law, the founding of Thelema, and explores all these things, really.
What is it they expect to see every night? A beast? A monster? Do they expect me to tear the heart from a baby and devour it still beating, just to bring a moment of sensation into their dull lives? Or perhaps they want me to conjure a demon. Every night I tell them, "Ladies and gentlemen, hold on to your seats! I bring you the Bornless Ritual!" Except I don't. At least, not all of it. Never the part that would kill me and bring a demon in my place. The blood sacrifice. I never take the knife, turn it, drive it in through flesh and sinew, down into my heart. I give them a charade for their shilling.
It's a strange thing, performing a play, and not impersonating Crowley, but trying to understand how he might have felt and what he thought and what was important to him. And every now and again, when I'm rehearsing it somewhere in various sheds and various places, little performance venues that I've used, I just think every now and again you get close to him. And when you do get close, it's almost as if there is another presence in the room. I see him sometimes standing watching, and I think when I get close, I see a light in the old man's eyes. So do come and see me. I hope you enjoy the show. If you can get to Edinburgh, it's a great event. The whole festival's brilliant. There are so many, many performances at Edinburgh Festival, The Fringe. So I'm looking forward to taking Aleister Crowley to the Edinburgh Fringe. I hope the play does a little to do justice to a man who I think
has been slandered by history. Do come along, there'll be more details on the Edinburgh Fringe website.